before we get into our passage this morning, I'd like to start with a list of reasons of why you should reject Jesus as king. Now, before you call Southern Seminary and tell them to take away my degree, hear me out here. Think about it. You've never seen Jesus. He's never audibly spoken to you. Sometimes it doesn't seem like he's listening to you either. You've never seen someone rise from the dead before. Jesus, his followers, they're not always the most well-behaved bunch, are they? Jesus' teachings, take his teachings. His teachings are not very popular with your friends or your neighbors or your colleagues or academics or some of the social elite. And on the flip side of things, there are just different lifestyles that you could run after today that would more tangibly address your felt needs. It could. If you decide to reject Jesus as king, you wouldn't have to be in a church building this morning. You could be out on the boat. There's so many different things you could be doing. You could give all of your emotional energy to people you can actually see with your eyes and people who actually can talk back audibly to you. I could keep going. There are just many reasons you should reject Jesus as king. But as we wrap up our 1 Samuel series this morning, I want to let you know that one day when you see Jesus face to face and you see the intense goodness of his authority and you experience the intricate dimensions of his restorative presence, well, on that day, all of those reasons that I just listed, all of the reasons that you may think about doubting Jesus' reign, all of those reasons, well, they're going to seem really silly. They're just going to seem very silly. Because the reality is, here's the reality. While sin's rule sometimes seems more stable than God, the rulers that we've made in our image, that you and I have made in our image, those rulers will one day die. And one day we will see that the ruler made in God's image will reign forever. That's what 1 Samuel chapters 28 through 31 are going to show us this morning. While sin's rule sometimes seems more stable than God, the rulers made in our image will die, and a ruler made in God's image will reign forever. So here's been my prayer for us this week as I've been preparing to speak with you all. I've been asking the Lord that he would help us by his Spirit detach ourselves even more from the kingdoms that are going to fail, from the temporal kingdoms that we're holding on to, the kingdoms that have a ticking time bomb on them, and that he would, by his grace and by his Spirit, help us grasp to cling even tighter to a more enduring kingdom, to the king, to the only king who will be left standing at the end of the day. It's spiritual sanity if we do this, and it's spiritual suicide if we don't. But before we press into all of those ideas that I've mentioned on the front end, I thought it would maybe be helpful to give a kind of a quick 30,000-foot overview of our passage this morning. Just kind of get a lay of the land, see how our passage unfolds. So we'll walk through these four chapters pretty quickly, and then the plan is to come back to some of the ideas that I just brought up, and we'll apply them to our lives. Does that sound good? You guys with me? I'm going anyways. It doesn't matter what you think. Well, like Tony just read for us, chapter 28 starts off pretty funky, doesn't it? It's a weird first two verses. In the first two verses, David agrees to be the bodyguard of Achish, a ruler in Gath, a city-state of Philistia. For the Philistines were God's enemies at the time, Israel's enemies. Achish is the guy David sought refuge under, if you remember back in chapter 27 when he's fleeing from Saul. He comes to Achish and he is willing to serve him. And all things considering, the arrangement had been going pretty well, actually, all the way up until chapter 28, when Achish, who is serving as a ruler with the Philistines, asks David to be his bodyguard. Well, Achish was going to go fight against the Israelites. So you can imagine the predicament, the pickle that puts David in, right? Fighting against his own men, his own people, the Israelites. It's a bizarre situation. And then the text switches back to Saul, the next section of chapter 28, and things get even weirder, don't they? When Saul realizes he has to fight the Philistines, he does as has been his custom. He spazzes out. He freaks out about this impending war that he has to go into, and he consults God. He tries to consult God, but when God doesn't respond to Saul, what does he do? Well, he goes to the medium of Endor to get advice about what to do. Breaking just a clear command in Deuteronomy chapter 18, verses 10 through 12, to consult mediums and necromancers. I hope that is a clear command in your mind. If you've been wondering of whether you should consult mediums, then don't do that. If you've thought about hiring a part-time necromancer, like, just stop. Black magic, not a good idea. It's a clear command. I don't understand what Saul's doing. He's just clearly going past something that God had told him not to do. And it just doesn't make sense. I mean, breaking a command to consult the soul of a prophet who had just relayed God's judgment against you? I mean, come on, Saul. I mean, it doesn't make any sense. In verses 15 through 19, Samuel's annoyed too. Samuel acts like me when Leah wakes me up from a nap. He's disturbed. He says in verse 15, he asks Saul, "Why have you disturbed me by bringing me up? I already told you that your reign's going to come to an end. I already relayed God's judgment against you. Why would you wake me up? Why would you bring me back for me to just tell you the same thing? If you don't mind, Saul, I'm just going to go back to bed." And with that, Saul does his best toddler impression and falls to the ground. Just throws himself on the ground, and he won't eat until he's coaxed and prodded to do so by others. Like I said, chapter 28 is just weird, and we'll come back to it in a minute. Chapter 29, it's a little bit more normal, still a little strange, but more normal. If you look over there in chapter 29, when the Philistine higher-ups find out that Achish had asked David, the Philistine-slaying Israelite hero warrior, to join them on a fight against Israel, well, they do what you and I would do. They uninvite David from that battle. They say, "Achish, what are you doing? Don't invite the guy who's just slayed our champion, Goliath, to come to the battle." This makes sense. I'd probably do the same. And even though David protests, I think this is actually a good thing for David. I think that God was protecting his servant, David, from going into a situation where he would have perhaps had to kill one of his own people, maybe even Saul, God's anointed. I think God's kindness and cares over David here. Anyways, regardless, in chapter 30, just kind of moving quickly through this overview on the beginning. In chapter 30, David heads back to Ziklag, where he had been staying with Achish. But when he gets back, if you've read the passage before, he comes upon a scene that he was not expecting. It's a tragic scene. When David and his men get back to Ziklag, they realized that the Amalekites had burned Ziklag and they had captured their families. You know, it's impossible to get inside David's mind, right? I mean, just imagine what it would be like to come back to that scene. to know that your family had just been taken. Exiled. Your family in the hands of evil men. Your people who trusted you now questioning your leadership. I don't know what I would think. It's impossible to put yourself in David's shoes. Here's David's reaction, though, in verses 6 through 8. Chapter 30, verses 6 through 8. And David was greatly distressed, for the people spoke of stoning him, because all the people were bitter in soul, each for his sons and daughters. But David strengthened himself in the Lord his God. And David said to Abiathar the priest, the son of Ahimelech, bring me the ephod. So Abiathar brought the ephod to David, and David inquired of the Lord, shall I pursue after this band? Shall I overtake them? He, being God, answered him, pursue, for you shall surely overtake and shall surely rescue. Which is exactly what David does. Even though 200 of his men were too tired to go, David takes his smaller band of 400 men and they seek after the men who had captured their families. And after they get some intel from one of the servants of the Amalekites, they stumble upon their family's captors. Here's what happens, verse 16, picking back up in chapter 30. And when he had taken them down, behold, they being the Amalekites, were spread abroad over all the land, eating and drinking and dancing, because of all the great spoil they had taken from the land of the Philistines and from the land of Judah. And David struck them down from twilight until the evening of the next day, and not a man of them escaped, except 400 young men who mounted camels and fled. David recovered all that the Amalekites had taken, and David rescued his wives. Nothing was missing, whether small or great, sons or daughters, spoil or anything that had been taken. David brought back all. David also captured all the flocks and herds, and the people drove the livestock before him and said, this is David's spoil. Not a bad day at the office, huh? Rescue your family, rout the enemy, receive the spoils. It gets better, actually. David doesn't just use these rewards on himself. He gives it to his men. Even the men who were too tired to go and fight. David's so kind. So kind. He takes some of the spoils and he gives it to his friends who are in Judah. Verses 26 through 30. Forgive me for some of these pronunciations, by the way. Just give me grace. When David came to Ziklag, he sent part of the spoil to his friends, the elders of Judah, saying, here is a present for you from the spoil of the enemies of the Lord. It was for those in Bethel, in Ramoth of the Negeb, in Jatir, in Aroer, in Ziphmoth, in Eshtemoah, in Rakal, in the cities of the Jeremelites, in the cities of the Kenites, in Hormah, in Borashan, in Athak, in Hebron, for all the places where David and his men had roamed. Look at David now, right? He didn't look like much when he was called from watching his father's sheep, but look at David now. Victor, just blessing his future kingdom with blessings from the spoils. Look at David. And look at Saul. If we flip over to chapter 31, while Saul looked the part earlier in the book, the last chapter of 1 Samuel recounts the final minutes of Saul's life. A Philistine archer spots Saul mortally wounding him, and when Saul's armor bearer won't end Saul's life, Saul takes the sword and he does it himself, thrusting himself through, falling on his own sword. Jonathan and Saul's other sons die. The Philistines occupy the cities that the Israelites fled after losing the war. And in the last verse of 1 Samuel, the Israelites bury Saul under a tamarisk tree. Ironically, the same kind of tree that Saul plotted the death of David. You know, Saul, a king made in Israel's image, looked like the right choice at one time, huh? David, a king in God's image, a man after God's own heart, didn't look like the right choice. In the middle of Samuel, Israelite political analysts would have probably made a good decision to bet that Saul's the one who's going to make it out alive at the end of the book, not David. And there were just many reasons to reject David as king. But notice, as we've kind of wrapped up this series in 1 Samuel, notice the differences as 1 Samuel comes to a close. God doesn't respond to Saul, but he responds to David. Saul fears the battle. David's ready for the battle. Saul's unfaithfulness leads to God's enemies invading Israel. David's faithfulness leads to God's enemies fleeing away from his people. Saul dies. David lives. And with that, all of those reasons to doubt David's reign, well, they kind of feel silly, don't they? This is the feeling that we will get, y'all, when we see Jesus face to face. When the books of our lives are closed, and all temporal kingdoms that we are holding on to, they come to an end, every reason to doubt the authority and the reign of King Jesus will seem really silly. It will make sense. But the reality is, if we're being intellectually honest, is that when the Amalekites have taken your family, when your kids are gone and you don't know how they're being treated, and when the most powerful man in your realm is seeking your life, well, that truth is kind of hard to believe, isn't it? It's difficult to battle the doubt. Sometimes, that's our first point for this morning, sometimes our rule can seem stable and God's rule can seem unstable. If we humble ourselves and just are honest with ourselves with each other, I think we feel that pretty often, don't we? Our rule can sometimes seem really stable. And God's rule can seem very unstable. Now, this is just straight propaganda, but one of the reasons why we think it's so true at times is because it just is coming to us from all sorts of different directions. Three main ones for us to look at here. It comes to us from the world, it comes to us from our flesh, and it comes to us from the devil. These are the three main news outlets that are trying to help you doubt the good authority of God. The world, the flesh, and the devil. And they are good at their jobs. They are good at doing this. But when I speak about the world, I want you to know, I don't mean planet Earth, just to be clear. As far as I'm concerned, I think our planet is doing just fine. Earth, keep spinning. You're doing great. I'm not talking about Earth or the world as our planet. I'm talking about in the sense that John talks about it in 1 John chapter 2, verses 15 through 17. He says, "Do not love the world or the things in the world. If anyone loves the world, the love of the Father is not in him. For all that is in the world, the desires of the flesh and the desires of the eyes and the pride of life, is not from the Father, but is from the world. And the world is passing away along with its desires. But whoever does the will of God abides forever." When John speaks about the world, he's talking about the sinful desires and the prideful ways of thinking that would reject Jesus as king, that would oppose God's rule. And if we're humble, I think we should recognize, first point, that we are susceptible to that powerful message of doubt that the world is just pumping out. We're susceptible to it. And the reason why we're susceptible to questioning God's good authority is because questioning his authority just appeals to our fleshly desires. Again, like we talked about with the world when I critique your flesh in a minute. I'm not talking about your skin. Your skin's fine, y'all. Don't worry about it. Talking about it in the way that First John is talking about it again, that your fleshly, your desires, that the desires that are against God's good authority. This is what makes temptation from the world so attractive, right? I mean, if our desires were satisfied in Jesus, the world, it wouldn't be tempting. We'd already be satisfied. We would just turn down the world like I turn down food that I don't find appetizing, like sweet pickles and all other nasty food that should be banned from existence. The reality is that the world does not look to us, to our flesh, like sweet pickles. No, when our flesh looks at the world, it looks at it like I look at a bowl of queso. It craves it. It wants it. Desires it. This is why we gobble up just the individualistic, anti-authoritarian messages that's in movies. And it is in, sorry to say it, Disney films. Hashtag Frozen. Hashtag Elsa. Hashtag Let It Go. What does she say? The great American poet Elsa. It's time to see what I can do to test the limits and break through. No right, no wrong, no rules for me. I'm free. Let it go. Are you glad I didn't sing that to you? Now, I'm not hating on Elsa here. I like Frozen. I think it's a good movie. I think it's fun to watch. Hopefully that doesn't offend your conscience. It's pretty witty. I like it. But you can see why we like to buy that message, right? It appeals to our flesh. In his book, Strange New World, Carl Truman makes the point, commenting on Elsa's lines there. He says that if there's no right and there's no wrong and there are no rules, well, what does that mean for us? Well, that means that we can reject Jesus as king. We can sit on the throne of our own lives. Oh, this appeals to our flesh, brothers and sisters. Our flesh can buy a message like no right, no wrong, no rules for me. And this is why Israel let the world influence them in 1 Samuel chapter 8. If you can kind of bring back your minds all the way back to our message back on 1 Samuel 8, when Israel wanted a king that looked like the nations. The reality is that the world was presenting to them a king that promised to satisfy the desires of their flesh. And Saul just fit that role. Or at least it seemed that he fit that role. I think this same kind of, the same principle of how our flesh determines the temptation from the world, I think that same principle applies to the devil too, and how he works with us. I heard a while ago a friend said that the devil plays upon our flesh like a concert pianist plays upon the keys. Satan's music is only possible with our keyboard. His temptations are strong because the desires of our flesh are strong. And he knows just how to package a message that appeals to those desires. Targeting our felt needs. Ignoring the things that we don't care about. Knowing when to come on strong, when to play it more chill. But when it comes to addressing your felt needs, Satan has an honorary doctorate in advertising. He knows how to be able to address the desires of your flesh, and he knows how to do it really, really well. I think this explains why Saul made that idiotic decision to consult the medium of Endor. Because just removed from the situation, you know, just thousands of years removed, looking back onto Saul's rationale, it just doesn't make sense, does it? Do you remember what Tony read for us in chapter 28, verse 5? What did he say? When Saul saw the army of the Philistines, he was afraid, and his heart trembled greatly. And when God didn't answer him, he went looking for a remedy, for a relief to his fear just controlling his decision-making. And he's willing to even go and descend into the spiritually dark realm. You see the chain reaction here? It was Saul's fear that led to Saul's unfaithfulness. It was Saul's fear that led Saul into Satan's domain. This is how Satan works. He loves to prey upon the desires of our flesh, and particularly our fears that our desires will not be satisfied. That's where he likes to go. So if you're afraid of losing control, what kinds of messages of doubt do you think Satan will try to plant in your mind? Doubts about whether God's really in control or whether his control is good. I mean, can you really trust God's sovereignty? Really? Are you sure? Does he really have things under control? Is he really using his control for your good? Doesn't seem like it sometimes. Maybe, just to be safe, you should exert more control of your family. Maybe a nice backup plan if God's not really in control. Maybe you should exert more control over your 401k and your finances and your future and your friends. Maybe you should exert more control over every domain of your life, just in case God's not really in control. Or if control is not the area that's pressing for you, maybe it's a relationship that you don't want to lose. And if that's the case, then my guess is that Satan's not going to spend his limited energy on talking about control with you. That's not what you're tempted with. Now, he's going to target whether Jesus is really enough for you relationally. Has God really been there for you lately? He sure seems distant at times. I mean, you've been praying about the same thing for a while. It doesn't feel like he's really giving you an answer. Is he really walking through this trial with you? Does he really want to be with you? I mean, is a king that you've never seen before up in heaven really enough for you? It'd sure be nice to have someone you could see with your eyes. You could hear their audible voice come back to you. Is Jesus really intimate enough for your needs? And in an age where so many relationships develop through our phones, I want to let you know that Satan is not above using the apps in your iPhone to entice you away from relational intimacy with Jesus. Maybe it's not too much of a stretch to compare our reliance upon technology with Saul's reliance upon the medium of Endor. Maybe. This is what Andy Crouch says. He makes the point. He says, think of magic, for the moment, as the quest for instant, effortless power, the ability to get things done without taking time and without requiring labor or toil. In the absence of magic or technology, getting anything done requires some amount of time, sometimes a great deal of time. But what if you could get the results without waiting? Likewise, in the absence of magic or technology, getting anything done requires effort, sometimes substantial effort. But what if you could get results with just the wave of a wand or a swipe of a finger, essentially effort-free? Now, I'm team iPhone. I'm all about the iPhone. But it is good for me to remember that Satan's also pretty good with an iPhone. He knows how to use it to address my deepest fears and the desires of my flesh. Satan's temptation is strong because the fear of not satisfying the desires of our flesh is strong. But y'all, hear me out here. We cannot let those fears rule us. And the moment when God's rule seems unstable and our rule seems stable, we can't let our fears dictate what we do, because here's what will happen. Richard Sibbes says, Satan gives Adam an apple and takes away paradise. Therefore, in all temptations, consider not what he offers, but what we shall lose. Every rule opposed to God finds itself in the same place that Saul found himself at the end of chapter 31, with its bones under a tamarisk tree. That's where every rule opposed to the sovereignty and the good rule of God finds itself. Because here's what's actually reality. Although our rule can seem stable and God's rule can seem unstable, the reality is God's rule is stable and our rule is unstable. God's rule is stable and our rule is unstable. This is what Hannah told us, right? Back in chapter 2, that the thesis statement of 1 Samuel. She told us this is what reality is. But if you're like me, I forget. So it's just good to remind ourselves again. So I know we read it a few weeks ago. We're going to read it again. 1 Samuel chapter 2, verses 1 through 10. This is Hannah's prayer that becomes the thesis statement for the book of Samuel. And Hannah prayed and said, "My heart exults in the Lord. My horn is exalted in the Lord. My mouth derides my enemies because I rejoice in your salvation. There is none holy like the Lord, for there is none besides you. There is no rock like our God. Talk no more so very proudly. Let not arrogance come from your mouth. For the Lord is a God of knowledge, and by him actions are weighed. The bows of the mighty are broken, but the feeble bind on strength. Those who were full have hired themselves out for bread, but those who were hungry have ceased to hunger. The barren has borne seven, but she who has many children is forlorn. The Lord kills and brings to life. He brings down to Sheol and raises up. The Lord makes poor and makes rich. He brings low and he exalts. He raises up the poor from the dust. He lifts the needy from the ash heap to make them sit with princes and inherit a seat of honor. For the pillars of the earth are the Lord's, and on them he has set the world. He will guard the feet of his faithful ones, but the wicked shall be cut off in darkness. For not by might shall a man prevail. The adversaries of the Lord shall be broken to pieces. Against them he will thunder in heaven. The Lord will judge the ends of the earth. He will give strength to his king and exalt the horn of his anointed." It's a beautiful prayer. It's a beautiful prayer. And as we've seen throughout the book, Hannah's prophetic words just are absolutely true. She's absolutely on point. But there are also other points in the book where those words sounded a bit naive, didn't they? Like they weren't really in touch with reality. I mean, when Israel wanted a king that looked like the other nations, and they scored Saul, a tall, good-looking guy with lots of money, Hannah's prayer looked a little bit out of touch with reality, didn't it? Like she just wasn't really in with the times. She's outdated. Good for the past, but maybe not good now. Or what about when we saw a shepherd boy take on a giant? God's rule didn't seem very stable then, did it? Or when Saul turned half of the book of 1 Samuel into one long manhunt for David? Or even in our passage here, when the future king of Israel is being asked to be the bodyguard of the enemies of God, God's rule does not seem very stable, does it? Hannah's prayer doesn't seem like it's connecting with reality. Or just thinking about if I was a refugee in Ziklag like David, found out that my family had just been captured, well, Hannah's prayer might have sounded a bit trite. Maybe a bit untrustworthy. But as we get to the last page of 1 Samuel, whose bones are under the tamarisk tree, y'all? And if we flipped over to the next page into 2 Samuel, who is making it out of 1 Samuel alive and about to receive the crown? whose sons are dead, and which king rescues his family and blesses his future kingdom with the spoils from his victorious war. You know, in the middle of the book, we couldn't see this. We couldn't see to the end of the book. And that made God's rule seem very unstable. It didn't seem like Jesus was on his throne. It didn't seem wise to trust our allegiance with God's rule. God's rule seemed unstable. But over it all, from the first verse to the last verse of 1 Samuel, well, there was no instability, not even a little bit. Actually, from our perspective now, the world, the flesh, and the devil were the ones that were unstable. We just couldn't see how God was sovereignly using them to prepare his people for a better future. Young parents in the room, I want you to picture this with me. Imagine, I was going to say today, but it's Sunday, so Chick-fil-A is closed. Imagine tomorrow you decide that you want to surprise your kids with a trip to Chick-fil-A to get milkshakes. But, sorry, if I'm looking at some of the young parents and you have kids in the room, sorry if I just ruined your afternoon and you're on the hook for Chick-fil-A tomorrow. But anyways, just continue with me here. Imagine you want to go and take them to Chick-fil-A, but you don't want to tell them that at the house. No, you think it would be more fun to get them into the car and drive over there and you don't not tell them until you got out in the Chick-fil-A parking lot. You think that would be more fun for them. So what do? You tell the kids to pile into your car. And because it's summer in South Florida and vans are unbearably hot right now, you get in and you're sweating and they're sweating, everyone's uncomfortable. And as kids do, they complain. They don't want to be in that hot car. No, they actually ask if they can get out of the car and go back inside, where it's more comfortable, where there's AC. That's what seems like the better option for them at the time. Now, which option is better? What would be most loving? To let them go back inside and miss out on the milkshake at Chick-fil-A? Or to let your five-year-old complain her way to Chick-fil-A and then tell her that she gets to have a milkshake? Y'all, God loves you too much to let you go back inside into the cold AC. He cares about you way too much to let you take control of your life. He loves you too much to do that, to give you the reins, to let you be the ruler of your own life. It's better for you to trust in him. Because in the comfort of your own rule, you will miss out on the blessings of his reign. And your reign will end up where Saul's reign ended up. A pile of bones under a tamarisk tree. And in that moment, every doubt that you had about the good authority of God, and every thought that you had that your reign seemed more stable, well, all of those reasons, all of those ideas, they'll seem really silly, won't they? When you see Jesus face to face. All of the reasons to reject his authority will seem very, very silly. Just cue the Roman soldiers who were protecting Jesus' tomb, right? I'm sure they weren't expecting a king to walk out of that tomb. On the Saturday after Jesus' death, I'm guessing they weren't ready for that tomb to be rolled away. No, but what happened on Sunday? Well, they found out that Jesus was king. And all of that doubt about his authority seemed very, very silly. You know, I get it that God's reign can sometimes feel very unstable. In the middle of suffering, in the middle of doubt, God's reign can seem very, very unstable. On Saturday, the world, the flesh, and the devil, they seem like way better options to rule our lives. But y'all, Sunday's just around the corner. So don't trust in what seems true. Don't trust in the rule that seems to be stable. Trust in the rule that is stable. Don't trust in your morality to save you. Don't trust in your own goodness to save you. Trust in the forgiveness that Jesus has purchased on the cross to forgive your sins. Don't trust in just the parts of Scripture that seem appealing to your flesh. Trust in all his word, even the parts that don't seem like they're in touch with your reality. Trust in the person who has a stable reign, not in the person or not in the thing that seems like they have the stable reign. I know that's hard. On Saturday, that's hard. Saturday after Jesus' death, in the moments when everything in you is telling you to reject Jesus' reign, it is hard. But y'all, Sunday's just around the corner. Let's pray. Father, I pray for faith for my brothers and sisters as they are in the midst of different kinds of doubt, different wrestling with different reasons to perhaps reject your son Jesus' reign in their life, wondering if it is good. Pray that they would be reminded again of our passage here throughout this week. They would look to the last verse of 1 Samuel and see where every reign opposed to your good reign winds up. I pray they would trust in the God who raises the dead, even when it doesn't seem like that's possible. Pray all these things in your son's name. Amen.